Okay, Liz. Last paper of the meeting.
Okay. So moving on to agenda paper 17. So this agenda paper also asks how IS 32 should be applied to a particular mandatorily convertible instrument. So the instrument described in this agenda paper has a stated maturity date, and at maturity, the issuer must deliver a variable number of its own shares to equal the instrument's par amount. However, that range is subject to a cap and a floor. The issuer must also pay interest on this instrument. The issuer has the right to settle the instrument at any time before maturity by delivering the maximum number of shares specified in the contract. So that is the fixed cap. Plus, if it does so, it also must deliver all of the interest in cash that would have been payable if the instrument had remained outstanding until maturity. So the submission focused on the issuer's early settlement right and asked how that feature should be assessed under IS 32. Expressed simply, whether and if so, when that feature should affect the instrument's classification. And as described in paragraph 52 of the paper, that determination has a significant effect on the instrument's accounting. We think that under IS 32, the issuer must classify an instrument consistently with the substance of the contractual arrangement. So the issuer can't assume that the instrument described in this submission is equity simply because it has the contractual right to deliver a fixed number of shares. So in other words, that feature doesn't automatically trump all of the other terms of the instrument. We think judgment will be required to determine whether the issuer's early settlement option is substantive. We think this assessment will depend on factors such as the instrument's term, the width between the cap and the floor, the issuer's share price, and the volatility of that share price. The issuer needs to consider whether there are any real economic or business reasons that it would exercise that early settlement option. Based on the facts in the submission, we question whether there is sufficient benefit in exercising the option given the costs of doing so. So the question for you is, do you agree with our analysis in the paper and the tentative agenda decision in Appendix A? Do you want to take another action, such as considering the accounting for the instrument described in paragraph 7 of the paper?
Comments? Charlotte?
I don't agree with that conclusion. I think what you've done is said that you have to assess whether it's a substantive option or not, but assuming it's not, this is the answer. And I think there are going to be cases when it is substantive or when it isn't clear, and I think you need to look at the answer in that situation. And I don't think it's necessarily just down to the economics. There will be business reasons. There can be business reasons why you want someone to own shares in your company. For example, if you may want protection in case of a hostile bid. And in that case, there will be business motivations for getting a shareholder on board, which are independent of the perceived economics. And for those situations, I think you should deal with what happens if it is substantive.
You would agree, though, that you don't want to just let somebody stick in a non-substantive bonus provision and let it flip the classification just on that basis.
I agree, but I think the way of looking at those has always been a very high bar to prove that something is non-substantive. There's almost an assumption that it's substantive unless there's evidence of otherwise, because there can normally be valid reasons for exercising something, and once you can point to a valid reason, you sort of have to bring it into account. It's almost back to the previous conversation. You don't bring probability of exercise or the likelihood that it is going to be exercised into account.
Martin?
Yeah, I do not agree with the tentative agenda decision with regard to the last part, because what we do is a kind of evaluation of the case, and I'm not really sure due to several points. One is, are we clear with the definition and with the principle? We could say, okay, it is fully within the control of the issuer. Therefore, as it is in full control of the issuer, to change it for a fixed number of equity instruments, it is equity and it has no liability. If we do not come to this kind of a conclusion, we have to ask the question, what is substantive, and where in the accounting standards we find something about this. And the staff argues with genuine and says that it is not genuine. And AG 28 tells us something that this is only when the occurrence is extremely rare, high, abnormal, and very unlikely. So this is something different than doing a kind of probability evaluation. So for me, therefore, it is important because, as we said before, economic compulsion doesn't count. Well, at least it's hard to find arguments against that there, in no reason at all, could be a situation where it makes sense to use this option.
John, Joanna, and Laurence.
Well, similar to Martin, I think you address this issue by substance. Is that a substantive? What's the substance of the transaction? I'm not sure if we look at a substantive transaction, we would have come to the conclusion we came with the previous issue. So I'd be very careful with that. I think your approach is to stick to the detailed rules of 32. So I think the rule says that you ignore if it's not genuine. So if you ignore the feature if it's not genuine, the threshold is much higher than what your paper indicates there. So I'm not sure that that your analysis is based on the genuine issue.
We didn't use genuine. We were specifically not using genuine. We were suggesting that there was another filter implicit in IAS 32.
Yeah, and just to clarify, so we included paragraph 55 as an example of where IAS 32 requires you to disregard a contractual feature for the purposes of classification. So our argument started with the assumption that 32 is based on contractual features. And then we make the argument that in some cases, 32 requires you to ignore particular contractual features. And not genuine in terms of contingent settlement features is just an example where 32 requires you to ignore contractual features. So our point is very consistent with what Wayne said a minute ago, that you can't just stick in a fixed settlement provision and assume that it's automatically going to trump everything else that's going on. You still have to consider whether that feature has substance.
Okay, well, there's my first comment is about the threshold that you should regard. My other comments is with respect to stating what the answer is for this particular fact pattern. I think I would refrain from that. I don't think we should go and say...
Point taken.
Yeah, okay.
Scott wants to jump the queue here, so.
And continue on with what Liz just said. If you can't just stick in a fixed settlement provision and assume that that trumps everything, why can you just stick in an option to not pay interest and assume that trumps everything, which it did on the last issue to get to view three?
Well, I think it's the difference between substance and economic compulsion. So in this particular paper, we're looking at the contractual rights and obligations that are set out in the contract, and we're saying, does each and every one of these have substance, which I think is exactly what IAS 32 requires you to do. What the board decided in 2006 is that what you cannot do is take something that's non-contractual and pretend that it is.
Right, well, the contractual right to avoid, the contractual right to skip paying interest is non-substantive.
Yeah, but I think
you ain't going to take advantage of it ever.
But I think
I don't see how that analysis. We will declare, you know, we have the option, we have the choice. We must make the evaluation of whether contractual provisions are substantive or not. It seems like that would apply in both instruments. I happen to agree with the staff's analysis in this paper. That by and large, the option to settle early by issuing more shares than you would have to issue if you waited is non-substantive. But I also agree that the option to skip paying interest is likely non-substantive.
I sense a bit of a concern that maybe there's that we might be inconsistent with what we choose to focus on in the document, and we're trying not to be. Maybe I think there's a few clear signposts in 32 that we have to work with, and we're trying to use those. So one of them is the fact that 32 is very firm on the fact that if you've got an unavoidable obligation to pay cash or to do something liability-like, like to deliver a variable number of shares, that's definitely a liability to be taken very seriously. At the other end of the spectrum, even if you think that you're always going to make a payment, if ultimately you've got discretion not to do it, then we're very clear that that's not a liability. So we've got those sort of two signposts. And in addition to that, the board in the past, as Liz said, has been very clear that you can't sort of write into the contract things that you think are going to happen if they're not there in black and white. So we're trying to sort of watch those signposts, but at the same time say, okay, you've got to look at the contractual terms, but the staff's suggestion is you need to make sure that you really think they're real. And we're certainly not saying that in the staff paper that any right to deliver a fixed number of shares should be ignored. It's rather, don't just take it at face value. It's more the argument.
But, I mean, and also, wouldn't you agree that having the discretionary dividends, I think, do have substance because I think they're very important for regulatory purposes. So I think having the right to cancel on a non-cumulative basis your interest payments is indeed very real.
But all you need to accomplish the regulatory goal is that you don't have to pay the interest if the regulator deems that you don't have sufficient capital to pay it. You don't need to have it be completely voluntary to meet that goal.
Okay, we're drifting here. Let's get back on sequence. Joanna?
Somewhat what Scott said, but in particular I think what John and Martin said, I actually think that paragraph 52, and this comes to number what Scott was saying, of your paper, is the key, and I support effectively what you have put there, and I think it's that paragraph 15 of IS 32 in terms of it's got to have substance, the contractual arrangement. So to me, 15 is the nub of it, and I'm taking it back up to the principal level and saying 15 is the nub of it in the principal level, and I would like to see the tentative agendas decision effectively back up at the principal level, and as Martin said, not actually opine on this particular instrument, but to say that you need to make the judgment here as to whether it is, and these are the options, in terms of whether it is in substance the contractual arrangement or not. So I'm supportive of your conclusions in paragraph 52. I understand some of Scott's concerns about the interest, but I do see them as different because I think in dividends, you absolutely have the ability, and as director of a bank, I know damn well that we can stop, you know, if we can stop dividends, we're doing it. The regulator may also direct us, but we actually have got our own bottler and we will stop paying if we think we have to stop paying. So I do see them as different, but that's where I'm at.
Laurence?
I do not support the staff proposal. I think it is going far beyond what IS 32 says and requires. While I agree with your conclusion in paragraph 65 that this situation requires judgment to determine whether the early statement option is substantive and you need to look at various factors, I disagree with what you write in paragraph 66, saying that in this present case, you necessarily conclude that this option doesn't have substance, and you say so because you believe that there is not sufficient evidence of benefits in exercising the settlement option plus the interest in the present case. And I think that by making this point, you are introducing in IS 32 a new criterion in the classification, which does not exist. That's the same thing as you explain in paragraph 60, where you say, we think that it is necessary to assess whether the issuer received sufficient benefit from that early settlement option, given the cost of exercising it. The assessment of the benefit beyond cost, as far as I understand IS-32, is not an element that triggers the classification, one side or the other. So I am consistent with my previous voting on agenda paper 18. I look at everything. I look at all the contractual terms. I look at AEG 28 in IS-32, and I make an assessment about whether that call option is genuine, that is looking at the events that can trigger the option, whether they are extremely rare, highly abnormal, and very unlikely to occur. So there is an assessment to be made, but that would not be so definitive in the answer you provide here, because as Charlotte said, there are many cases where effectively you can understand why there is this call option, and maybe it's not economical the way you see it, but there may be a larger picture why you are doing so and why you want to exercise that call option, which makes it genuine. But this has to be assessed on a each case basis. Well, on your other question about paragraph 7 and whether we should look at the basic instruments without the call option, I completely support that we look at this type of instrument, because there is currently diversity in assessing whether it is a liability or an equity instrument. And for those who believe it is an equity instrument, or at least that there is an equity piece into it and possibly a derivative part in that instrument, introducing that call option, and when you look at the whole instrument, it is less, I would say, shocking for those individuals than to have an equity component into that instrument compared to those who believe that the basic instrument should be classified as a liability in its entirety. So I do believe that it is necessary to clarify the accounting for the basic instrument itself.
I think we should take on board the advice that we are not trying to opine on a particular we're not in the product design business here. And so we want to pull back a little bit, and I'm going to ask the staff to think about that while others are talking, of how we pull back from that and try and articulate, I think, the point that Sue made about there being signposts. How do we articulate that? Andrew, I think you were next.
Well, I support the staff's conclusion that this instrument is a liability, and I'd like taking on board that we're not going to opine on particular instruments to nonetheless have an agenda decision which points in that direction, at least, because it does this issue a call option does feel like it might have been inserted just to get an accounting result. But like some others, like Laurence and Martin and Jean have spoken, I feel the analysis and the draft decision does rather elevate the role of the substantive test as a kind of initial filter that you go through before you apply the more detailed requirements of IS-32, and then goes too far into interpreting, if it is that kind of filter, how it should be applied. And we talked about unintended consequences in the context of paper 18. I feel that in introducing or elevating the role of substantive and using words like sufficient benefit for the USU, where we are in danger of unintended consequences, too much interpretation.
Tony?
yeah, I agree with the staff's conclusion, but I think I also agree with everybody else that we shouldn't be opining on the specific instrument. Mm-hmm. But I do agree with the conclusion that, boil it down to its simplest, you can't just invent a redundant contractual term to change the accounting. Mm-hmm. And I think that, to me, comes through from some of the words in the agenda decision before it gets into talking about the specific instrument.
And Wayne, maybe on that point, if I could suggest something with regards to the tentative agenda decision that actually might be responsive to everything we've heard here. It sounds like the concerns with the tentative agenda decision are really on the next to last paragraph. So the paragraph that starts, however, based on the facts provided. Yeah. So if we deleted that paragraph and stuck with this notion that you have to apply judgment.
Yeah. Yes. And focus more just on the substance point.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I think that's what people have really been wanting guidance on.
Yeah.
Okay. Martin, I guess you're up next.
Yeah, but I mean, we heard several times the word substance, and what does substance really mean? I'm not sure whether we all have the same understanding about substance. It is, well, challenging in a way to get the interpretation of substance out of IS 32. Because I could either argue, well, substance mean, well, whether the conditions for equity and a liability are clearly fulfilled, yes or no, or otherwise substance could be go much more beyond into the details, probability, weighted, whatever, and evaluate the whole structure. I believe that I would interpret substance as the first one and not the second one. However, it is extremely important to understand any agenda decision when we make reference to substance. What we do, what do we mean by substance? I guess it's more easy to argue with genuine and not genuine because there we have more or better defined criteria.
I guess in the draft agenda wording we've tried to sort of expand a bit on substance by talking about whether there's a real economic business reason for the option.
Yes, but is this substance? I mean, substance could also be, are the criteria for equity fulfilled? I mean, if you look in IS 32.18, there it says the substance offer could also label it as the content of financial instruments should be the substance of a financial instrument rather than its legal form governs its classification. So what is the substance? I might argue criteria for equity are fulfilled, so it's equity.
I'm going to use you as an example next time somebody wants to argue substance over form. But that notwithstanding, it seems to me we are on a continuum. Genuine, I would describe a feature that said such and such will happen if the last surviving descendant of Queen Victoria dies. There are so many surviving descendants of Queen Victoria that event will not happen absent a Holocaust. So I would say that's certainly a non-genuine feature. It's also non-substantive. The difficulty is the continuum, I guess. Reinhardt, I had you next.
Just a couple of points. I agree with the staff conclusion because the way I looked at the instrument, this starts off as a liability. I mean, it is, you pay interest, it's got a state of maturity date, there's a variable number of shares that are deliverable. And to me, in the discussion of substance, I focused on a couple of things. One is, I know, like the staff, they looked at paragraph 20 of IS 32, where it talks about where the principle of where you have a choice of either giving cash or a variable number of shares, and then it essentially says that you've been guaranteed an amount of the cash settlement. Here, given the way this instrument is structured, you're guaranteed to get the variable number of shares up to the maximum amount. So I was persuaded by that, by applying that principle by analogy. Maybe what would help in terms of the wording of that paragraph where we talk about judgment will be required to determine if it's substantive is to focus on whether the ability of the issuer to settle early substantively negates the contractual obligation to deliver a variable number of shares. Pull it back to that level.
I like that. We'll see. matters what I like. John.
I agree with the staff that paragraph 20 should be used to assess whether the option, early settlement option, has substance. And I agree with the other comments that I don't think we should get into assessing the substance of this particular instrument or even in providing any further criteria for what is substantive. I think that will depend upon facts and circumstances. As Charlotte said, there can be lots of reasons why the early settlement option might be substantive in particular circumstances. I do think that the accounting for the underlying instrument should be taken on. There is diversity in practice on that issue, and I think that that should be addressed.
Okay, Scott?
This discussion is interesting and also somewhat troubling to me, remembering back to my days as a regulator. What we're concerned about here is abuse. Is this provision settled by issuing the maximum number of shares put in here just to achieve an accounting result? If it is, we do not want it to achieve that accounting result. We also do not want the standard setter to be in the business of writing the anti-abuse provisions. It seems to me that perhaps what we need to do here is write enough so that the regulators have what they need to stop the abuse without putting ourselves in the business of writing standards or agenda decisions or whatever else to stop all the abuses. So I guess in that regard, I'm asking help from our regulator friends.
Excuse me.
What can we do to help give you the tools you need to stop this? Or do you feel like we need to be very specific in order to help you stop this? I mean, I would look at this in general and say, I don't really care what the accounting standards say. Non-substantive things ought never drive the accounting. I don't really care whether the standard says non-substantive things don't count. They don't. And if we need to write something to make sure they don't, okay, we can write it. But, you know, I think to some extent that is the role of the regulators to make sure that's not happening. At least traditionally, we've looked at it that way, and we have not tried to write IFRS to slam every door because we know that is a futile endeavor for a standard setter.
Okay. Gary with board member privilege. Then I have Andrew. Andrew doesn't want to come in. And John, and I'm going to let Julie bet clean up, and then I'm going to suggest something here. Gary?
This observation, I actually agree with the staff's conclusion, but similar to where Scott is, I'm wondering, I'm on the Appendix A, the very last line on the last paragraph on the left side, which says, whether the primary reason for including the feature was to achieve a desired accounting outcome. And I'm just wondering, does that actually sort of subterfuge the objective of the conclusions here? Because I could sit there and say, that's not the primary reason we put this feature in. I'm communicating with these draconian call features. You, the holder, the buyer of these instruments, they're never going to be called. You can count on it going to maturity. And I would sit there, if I was the treasurer or a CFO or the investment banker designing this thing, say, that is not the primary reason. It is that is your lock-solid commitment you're going to maturity on this thing, because the poison pill is really poisonous to do otherwise. So I'm just wondering, instead of saying whether the primary reason for including the desired accounting outcomes that might be able to be circumvented would be to say, for example, the pricing of the primary instrument would not be significantly changed absent this provision, or something like that.
Okay.
So I'm where we want to be. I'm just wondering, does this contravene it?
John?
Yeah, my comment is actually on that same clause. I think it's unnecessary to speculate on the motivations for putting that clause in the instrument, and that's what that does. I mean, it might achieve a particular accounting outcome, but I don't think
it, I mean,
we ought to, I don't think the interpretation or the rejection notice ought to be speculating on the motivation for including the clause.
So you take those words out? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we could just stop the paragraph after option.
Yeah. Okay. Julie, last call. Oh, then I got to go to the phones. Excuse me.
So just overarching comments in stylistic in terms of drafting what you're going to end up with. You know, when I first looked at this, it said, my first question is, what's the business reason behind the structure? Because we just have the structure, but we don't have what it's, you know, what's compelling it. So, of course, being a regulator, my immediate reaction, absent knowledge, was skepticism. And I said, you know, is this written in by someone who's innocently lost in our literature, or someone who either is the one side or the other, the designer or the taker of this? And it didn't strike me. It strikes me as too complicated to be someone who's innocently, you know, woke up and found themselves having entered into one of these, thoughting they just signed a term loan arrangement, and then realizing when they went to do the journal entries that there was a lot more to it. And then being lost in the literature and you know, pleading here for help. So I was more skeptical and said, it seems like there's some accounting outcome that may be part of the dynamic. Again, absent knowing the business purpose, so I couldn't give the full credibility to what the economic motivation was. And so then, of course, being a regulator, I said the worst thing I thought IFRA could do was give, you know, a particular, in essence, take the bait and give a particular answer and then turn into the free labor shop for perpetuating things. So it seemed like the best answer could be the messages that in a rejection that said, you know, that emphasized what was critical in the literature to get the right model applied and follow the economics to extent, you know, it talks about that except where it precludes it. As opposed to, and sort of just, with all due respect to the persons who submitted this, but I was a little skeptical when their submission didn't tell what, you know, what the business motivation was. So, in essence, just as maybe Scott said, give the auditors and the regulators and the issuers, everybody, something to work with, just a reminder of what's called for. Versus, because like I said, absent knowing more, I didn't strike me as an innocent, you know, oh my gosh, we're lost, can you please bail us out?
I think this approach is particularly useful here because I think there is a perception out there that IAS 32 tells you just read the contract and don't sort of think outside the box. And so I think that this is helpful for regulators and audit.
Okay. I've heard a couple of things. Number one is phones, excuse me. Sandy?
Yeah. I guess I've had a lot of thoughts along the way, but didn't want to necessarily interrupt. I don't agree with the wording in the notice that this basically has no substance. I don't think you have enough information to do that. I don't agree with the analysis for some of the reasons I believe it was Laurent said in 66. It was a long time ago, so I apologize. I don't remember exactly what she said. So I agree with I don't agree that you can decide based on what you have here whether or not this feature has substance or not. And I believe it was Gary's point with respect to removing, and then Liz followed on with removing the language after the option, because I think that the real question at hand is the substance, and I don't think that, I think you have to evaluate that, and I don't think the analysis necessarily does that. So I guess I'm on board with the fact that we should say that you should evaluate it based on the substance and that we should not conclude with respect to this particular feature or this particular instrument, I should say.
Yeah, I had already struck out the paragraph that begins, however, on the basis, because that is opining on the instrument. Luca?
the fact that the topic is complex is absolutely clear, but I share the majority of the comments made by Laurence. I think that there is the risk that we are taking a step forward and that we are going a little bit farther than what is nowadays indicated inside the AFRCC.
Okay, thank you. All right. I think it's a given that we're not going to opine on the specific instrument. I heard a lot of references to non-substantive or Tony's comment about an additional redundant feature. I think the staff has a lot that they need to work with in terms of rewriting. Now, the question, and I'm agnostic about the answer, is do you want to see that and try and clear it in drafting, or do you want to see it at the next meeting? This one strikes me as one that could go either way, and so I'm at the mercy of the committee. Or more correctly, Liz is at the mercy of the committee. Laurent?
Thinking of timing, this is a very lively issue. If an agenda rejection is published in the July IFRIC update, this means that it will be finalized in November, hopefully. So before the year end.
Yeah.
If we postpone to the September meeting, this means it postpones its finalization to the January meeting. And because it is a lively issue, I think it is, if we can publish something in July so as to finalize our views before the year end, I think this would be helpful.
Okay, well, we will operate on that basis then, unless I see an objection. Obviously, if it turns out that we can't get it done, we always have the option to say, no, we need to bring it back, but we'll try. Okay, thank you.
That is true. So the other question was whether the Interpretations Committee wants us to bring back an analysis of the what we've called the simple instrument in paragraph 7.
Okay, we will.
Okay.
That'll be fun.
Okay, that, I believe, is that. We're done.